Hello, and welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled, The Largest Nation on Earth, Russian and Ukrainian History, Part 3. The date, March 2022, and my name is Belisarius Avis. Quote, Peter, who broke his enemies on the rack and hanged them in Red Square, who had his son tortured to death, is Peter the Great. But Nicholas II, whose hand was lighter than any czar before him, is Bloody Nicholas. In human terms, this is irony, rich and dramatic, the more so because Nicholas knew what he was called. Unquote. Robert K. Massey, author of Nicholas and Alexandra. Here's a trivia question. What is the largest country entirely in Europe by landmass? The answer is Ukraine. But note the insertion of the word entirely. If the same question were stated for Asia, the answer would be China. But take out entirely, and the answer for the largest country by land in Europe is Russia. And the same for Asia. This reality of geography has been a singular definition of Russia itself and its history. In my previous podcast, I noted that the sole reason for the current Russian invasion of Ukraine is Vladimir Putin and his ambitions. Now, Tim Miller of The Atlantic has a different take. After listing the several countries that have invaded Russia from the West, including Poland, Sweden, France, and Germany, he tries to make a case that geography has prompted this issue. Writing for The Atlantic in 2018, quote, Russia has been invaded several times from the West. For example, in Poland, the plain is only 300 miles wide from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Carpathian Mountains in the south. But after that point, it stretches to a width of about 2,000 miles near the Russian border. And from there, it offers flat route straight to Moscow. Thus, Russia's repeated attempts to occupy Poland throughout history, the country represents a relative narrow corridor into which Russia could drive its armed forces to block an enemy advance towards its border, which, being wider, is much harder to defend. You see, according to this guy and according to The Atlantic, by definition, this is why Putin is invading Ukraine, because it's for his own protection. But also by that logic, he then means to invade Moldova and probably eventually Belarus and Poland itself to get to that 300-mile Polish plain. It's rubbish. First off, the concept of geography as a beckoning call to invasion is spurious. Italy has unique geography with the top of its boot surrounded by a ring of high alpine mountains. However, this has not stopped the Celts, the Carthaginians, the Franks, the Germans, the French, and the Austrians from attempting and often succeeding in conquest. And Miller's reasoning is of a piece with Putin himself in existence in historical terms. Miller inadvertently thinks we live in the 1600s, not the 2020s. Who exactly are these Russian invaders of our age? The Germans who cannot meet the minimal 2% defense spend required by NATO? The Swedes? The French? Does Emmanuel Macron possess the beating heart of a Napoleon Bonaparte beneath all of that liberal posturing? There are the Poles, of course, and maybe Erdogan of Turkey will want to reconstitute the Ottoman Empire, so both Iraq and Russia must watch out. And then, of course, there is the United States. This United States, the one that just abandoned Afghanistan to the fate of the Taliban? That's the America that Putin has to fear, along with all these other so-called enemies? My point here is that there has been a lot of apologists for Putin out there. And this is something I refuted in my first podcast, but I'm going to keep laboring on because it's silly. The reason that there is a horrific, awful war in Ukraine is the ambitions of a single man. But that single man didn't come out of nowhere. He has 190,000 troops. He was freely elected back in an election in the late 1990s. And up until recently, he enjoyed a measure of popularity. Rather, the point of these podcasts is to illustrate both the authoritarian nature of Russia and why it is different. And in this case, in this podcast, it is different because of its geography. One of the few things that Miller does write makes some sense. Quote, On the other hand, Russia's vastness has also protected it. By the time an army approaches Moscow, it is already unsustainably long supply lines, which become increasingly difficult to protect as they extend across Russian territory. Napoleon made this mistake in 1812, and Hitler repeated it in 1941. Unquote. Yet again, who are these armies, after taking down Belarus first, that will make the trek, as Miller puts it? I use the comparison of Italian invasions. The Celts in the 400s BCE, the French in the 1400s CE, and again in the 1800s, and the U.S. Army in 1943 successfully conquered Italy. Russia's would-be invaders, not so much. The one thing that all of these invaders, whether they be Swedish, whether they be French or Germans, all failed. And of course, we come to the NATO did it apologists. I have addressed that again in my previous podcast, but suffice it to say that fish have to swim and brutal dictators must distract and find justifications when they suspend personal rights and put detractors into prison. Yet, and this is the point of this particular podcast that I made just a moment ago, Russia is not North Korea. It's not Cuba. It's not Iran or the newly constituted Nicaragua. It has nukes. Let me repeat that. It has nukes. Scary enough. That's a big problem. But Russia is also big. The biggest in terms of a landmass, big in terms of 144 million compared to the 25 million in North Korea, the 11 million in Cuba. It borders 14 countries as opposed to the two of the United States. Now, Vincini, the clever Sicilian in the Princess Bride movie, states, "You've fallen for one of the two classic blunders. The first is never get involved in a land war in Asia, but only slightly lesser known, never go against a Sicilian when death is on the line." Ha ha ha! Vincini starts laughing, and then he falls over dead. He did engage in a contest with Wesley or Dread Pirate Roberts, whatever. If you've seen the movie, you'll get why that's a joke. And then he lost. He was trying to out-clever, and he out-clevered himself right into death. The problem, in addition to Vincini's never suspecting that Wesley or the Dread Pirate Robert, if you have, had built an immunity to iocane powder, is also, in addition to that basically mortal mistake, is that he was wrong about the land war in Asia. You can actually win a land war in Asia. A people once did it. You can win if one possesses a highly mobile force that can exist on grass and fight from horseback. The Mongols won many land wars in Asia, but with their ponies, they could move in numbers, at speed, and never rest. In addition, the frigid temperatures of the steppe were alleviated because the Mongols brought their shelters with them, and having been bred as well as their ponies, to suffer extreme weather. The average American gets upset if their Starbuck order is incorrect, and the average American liberal if their pronouns are mislabeled. But on the other hand, the average Mongol would travel nearly, roughly 60 miles per day and could endure below zero temperatures or effectively fight at a temperature of 80 degrees Fahrenheit. To correct Vincini, a modern army constituted after the 1500s should not fight a land war in European Russia. Keep that in mind. All of those wars when we had mentioned before, the Poles, the Swedes, the French, the Germans, were all fought in Europe. Russia has been invaded several times from the West. The Poles came across the European plain in 1605. The Lithuanians invaded from the north and were followed by the Swedes under Charles XII in 1707. The French under Napoleon in 1812 and the Germans twice. Everyone remembers Hitler's invasion, grandiosely named Operation Barbarossa in 1941. But remember, Germany had invaded Russia before in 1914, but of these only. The 1914 Germans were not only victorious, but they were not really invading. And they were not necessarily the primary reason that it fell. The war itself obviously didn't help, but the Tsar's mismanagement of the war and the massive casualties inflicted upon the Russian armies, both against the Germans and the Austrians, what primarily brought the Tsarist regime to its end. The more significant part of the German army itself was in the Western Front, And the war in the Eastern Front did not end until the Bolsheviks assumed power in the later part of 1917 and removed Russia from the war. The challenge for all of these armies was that modern European forces needed supplies brought in. Whether it be gunpowder or the guns themselves, cannon or other equipment, it was impossible for the armies that invaded in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries to live off the land the way the Mongols did. This disability was exacerbated as modern armies became mechanized in the 20th century. Now, a panzer unit could travel the same distance as a pony-supported Mongol army, but petrol does not arise from the ground like grass does. It has to be shipped in, and when the source of that supply is hundreds of miles to the west, it presents an issue. Even today, we hear of Putin himself and his vaunted Russian army facing issues with keeping his own highly mechanized army on the move. That is probably not due to a lack of petrol, Russia is the second largest oil exporter, or long supply lines, but logistical incompetence, another bane of the modern force. Napoleon himself stated, quote, "The amateurs discuss tactics, the professionals discuss logistics," unquote. We shall now look at how an outlier of the Mongol Empire, and once even of the Kievan Rus, the Grand Duchy of Moscow became the nation we know today, and we will start with the largest part, Siberia. The Russian conquest of Siberia took place in the 16th and 17th centuries. Much of Siberia was being ruled by descendants of the original Mongol invasions. The Khanate of Sibir became a loose political structure of vassalages that were being undermined by the activities of Russian explorers. Although outnumbered, the Russians pressured the various family-based tribes into changing their loyalties and establishing distant forts from which they conducted raids. The Russian conquest of Siberia began in earnest in July 1580, during the last years of the reign of Ivan IV, the Terrible, when a force of Cossacks, and we're going to learn a little bit more about Cossacks later on in this podcast, invaded the territory of the Vogels, subject to what, at the time, was the Khan of Siberia. The point was to subjugate the natives and collect Yasek, or fur tribute. A series of winter and outposts and forts called ostrogs were built at the confluence of major rivers, streams, and essential portages. The first among these was built in 1586, but other defenses and subsequent conquests were conducted in the north in 1593 and 1600, and the east in the 1590s. Advancing up the Ob and its tributaries, the ostrogs of Kesk and Tomsk were built. The Russians reached the Yenisei in 1605, and the final ostrogs were constructed in 1619 and 1628. What is interesting is, back at the homeland, primarily centered on Moscow, this was the time of troubles and severe famine. But nevertheless, all through this period, from the end of Ivan's reign up until the inception of the Romanovs under Michael Romanov, the conquest of Siberia proceeded apace. Following the last Khan's death and the dissolution of any organized Siberian resistance, the Russians advanced force towards Lake Baikal and then the Sea of Okhotsk and the Amur River. However, when they first reached the Chinese border, they encountered people equipped with artillery pieces, and here they halted. Finally, the Russians reached the Pacific Ocean in 1639. After the conquest of the Siberian Khanate, the whole of northern Asia, an area much larger than the original Khanate, became known as Siberia. And by 1640, the eastern borders of Russia had expanded more than several million square miles. In a sense, the Khanate sort of lived on, and one of the titles of the Tsars was the Tsar of Siberia, which became part of the full imperial style of the Russian autocrats. So, by 1640, all of Siberia is in place, and that push to the Pacific Ocean. And at some point, we won't really cover it as much here, they do cross the Bering Sea and take Alaska, all to be in the late 1860s a purchase of Alaska from the Russians. And the Russians were the original settlers there, as far as European settlers, would became a part of the United States. But they have Russia today goes all the way to the Pacific, all the way, remember that they border Belarus and the Ukraine in Europe, all the way across that huge landmass. It's really, it's almost staggering to try to imagine the sheer size of the Russian state. And this was still when Russia basically was kind of a medieval entity. But it is one thing to conquer vast chunks of little peopled areas of Asia. But really, it was the dream of the Tsars, really from Ivan IV on, that they would have access to the sea, either the Baltic Sea in the north or the Black Sea in the south. And in this case, there were two empires barring their way, the Swedish Empire, which was built in the early 1600s, and the Ottoman Empire in the Black Sea in the south. We're going to start with that first one because we're going to go back to a figure we visited in the last podcast, and that would be Peter the Great. Though the Russians had fought the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and the Polish Confederation, in Sweden's Charles XII, Russia faced an adversary who was not content with a simple provincial land grab, but sought to destroy the Russian state. In very real terms, Charles XII was sort of the precursor to Napoleon and Hitler. Again, he wasn't invading just to get a province or a city or two. He wanted to destroy the Russian state and therefore be the unquestioned leader of the entire north of Europe. And therefore, this kicked off the Great Northern War, which took place between 1700 and 1721. It was a conflict in which a coalition led by Russia successfully contested the supremacy of the Swedish Empire in northern, central, and even eastern Europe. The Battle of Pultova, fought July 8, 1709, was the decisive and most significant battle of the Great Northern War. A Russian army under the command of Tsar Peter, at that point he was still the Tsar, later he would style himself emperor, defeated a Swedish army under the command of Karl Gustav Reinskold. Charles XII, a warrior king in his own right, was wounded and did not direct the battle. Nevertheless, Pultova put an end to the status of the Swedish Empire as a great European power and its eastbound expansion and marked the beginning of Russian supremacy in Northern Europe. So what is even more interesting is that the battle was not fought in modern-day Russia, but Pultova was fought in modern-day Ukraine. Now, why would a Swedish army that's ostensibly based on, well, you know, Sweden, coming over from Finland, which at that time was a Swedish possession, be all the way down south in the Ukraine? And the reason is, we're going to meet these people for the first time, the Cossacks. A large army of Cossacks under Hetman Iva Vmesepa had formed, and Charles, after a terrible winter, not a new thing, had halved his force, and these terrible winters were a theme that later struck terror into French and German soldiers as well as the Swedish ones, decided to move southwards into Ukraine and join Mazepa. So Charles is trying to join Mazepa to provide a united front, and those Cossacks were then in revolt against Peter. With his victory over Sweden, though, Peter regained Ingria and finished Karelia and acquired Estonia and Livonia with the ports of Narva, Ravel, and Riga. Why are these names important? Because those latter cities are now located in what we call the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. And, as noted by Putin, were once part of Russia. And now, in a sense, they are claimed by Putin. But what is the issue with the Baltic states? So, given that they're far, far smaller than the Ukraine, why wouldn't Putin just take those back? Because they have members of NATO, unlike the Ukraine. We have looked north and east, and now we will look south to where the Russians begin to conquer what is now modern Ukraine. But first, we're going to start with the Cossacks. So who were these people? They are a group of predominantly East Slavic Orthodox Christian people who became known as members of a democratic, self-governing, semi-military communities that originated in the steppes of Eastern Europe, in particular along the Dnieper River. They inhabited sparsely populated areas and islands in the lower Dnieper, Don, Terek, and Ural River basins. The Don River is actually one of the great rivers of Ukraine. It was then and it is now. Early proto-Cossack groups are generally reported to have come into existence within what is now Ukraine in the 13th century, although some have ascribed their origins to as early as the mid-8th century. In the 15th century, Cossack society was described as a loose federation of independent communities, which often formed local armies, but were also independent from neighboring states such as Poland, the Grand Duchy of Moscow, and the Crimean Khanate. What's interesting is in this period, it's the 15th century. Remember, the Mongols have been thrown out of where they used to be near the Grand Duchy of Moscow. They have primarily been thrown out of Siberia. They still exist, or at least their descendants still existed in the 15th century in the Crimean Khanate. The Cossacks may have served as self-defense formations organized to defend against raids conducted by neighbors. But by 1492, the Crimean Khan complained that Kanov and Cherkasy Cossacks had attacked one of his own ships in the Sea of Azov. And the Grand Duke of Lithuania, Alexander I, promised to find the guilty party. Sometime in the 16th century, the old Ukrainian Ballad of Khan Sakholeda appeared about a Cossack near Kalilia. In the 16th century, these Cossack societies merged into two independent territorial organizations and other smaller, still detached groups. We have mentioned the hegemony of the Polish in the regions inhabited by Cossacks, and Lithuania had a piece of that too. But there was the Astrakhan Revolt, is the name given to a war in 1707 and 1708 between the Don Cossacks and the Tsardom of Russia. One of the first times in which we see these two forces in direct conflict. Kondraty Bolovan, a democratically elected ataman of the Don Cossacks, led this rebellion. The conflict was triggered by several underlying tensions between the Moscow government under Peter I of Russia, the Cossacks, and Russian peasants fleeing from serfdom in Russia to gain freedom in the autonomous Don area. Remember, at this point, the Cossacks, even though they were supposedly under the hegemony of the Polish, still operated with a great deal of independence. The other interesting thing about this period is that they call this a rebellion. But Peter's claim to the area where the Cossacks lived was tenuous at best. He hadn't formally conquered it, yet it was still called a rebellion to imply that Russia had the land, and that when the Cossacks rose up, they were actually rejecting their rightful ruler. In the last podcast, we ended with Peter, but it should be noted that upon his death, his wife, Catherine I, set a precedent for Tsarina rule. And for a wife to succeed a husband, something important in the other great in Russian history. For a country backward economically and medieval in many of its worldviews, during the period from Peter's death in 1725 to Catherine II, the other great I just mentioned, who died in 1796, 64 out of those 71 years saw female rule of Russia, with Tsarinas Catherine I, Anna, Elizabeth, and finally Catherine II. Such is the hold of Catherine II that we have been treated to not one, but two TV shows celebrating her in the past 3 years. The first, from HBO, takes a sober historical look at the Tsarina. The second, called simply The Great on Hulu, features a group of people named for historical figures, but has very little pretensions towards accuracy, as this hilarious show prominently points out itself. Here we come under the confluence of Russian and Ukrainian history once again. So remember how Peter extended his rule north with his beating of Sweden in the Great Northern War? He was also, and less successfully, trying to extend his rule south. Hence, that revolt in 1707 and 1708, or called a revolt, by the Don Cossacks in that region. This was, again, Ukrainian territory. Now, the conquests begun under Ivan IV are primarily completed under Catherine, whose armies completed the conquest of Ukraine and pushed out any of the Polish or Lithuanians who were still there and eliminated any pretensions on the part of the Cossacks for independence. What's interesting about the Cossacks, though, is that as history wore on, a lot of the Tsars began to use them as personal guards. And by the time of the revolution of 1917, which ended with Lenin and the Bolsheviks taking power, the Cossacks were actually in favor of the Tsars. For centuries, the Lithuanians and the Polish had controlled this territory, but Lithuania was largely destroyed under Peter I, and under Catherine, Poland itself ceased to exist as a state. Without those states vying for supremacy, Russia is left alone to finish the effort started centuries ago and, in a sense, reconstitute the Kievan Rus, but not centered on Kiev. No, this time it was centered on Moscow and St. Petersburg. As historian Carolyn Harris, writing for the Smithsonian, notes, quote, Catherine, who ruled from 1762 to 1796, represented herself to the world as an enlightened autocrat who did not govern as a despot, but as a monarch, guided by the rule of law and the welfare of her subjects. Yet at the same time, she annexed much of what is now Ukraine through wars with the Ottoman Empire and the partition of Poland, and brutally suppressed the largest peasant rebellion in Russian history, unquote. Catherine was actually not born to rule Russia. She was actually born Princess Sophie. She grew up the daughter of Prince Christian of Anhalt-Zerbst, a tiny German principality. That's one of the most interesting things, I think. One of the most, obviously the greatest of the Tsarinas, but one of the most powerful monarchs in all of Russian history wasn't Russian. She was German. She was raised to marry a prince rather than rule in her own right. And in 1744, when Sophie was just 15 years old, Empress Elizabeth of Russia selected her to be the wife of her nephew and heir, the future Tsar Peter III. They were married in St. Petersburg in 1745, and Sophie embraced her new home. Peter III came to the throne in 1762 and threatened to incarcerate her in a convent so that he could marry his mistress. Big mistake. Instead, Catherine seized the throne via a military coup orchestrated by her lover, Grigory Orlov, and his brothers with the support of the military class and the Russian Orthodox Church. And what happened to poor Peter? Well, one theory is that Peter III, Catherine's now deposed husband, was killed in a drunken brawl with a guard. That sounds right. So let me get this straight. Catherine overthrew her husband, who is actually a direct descendant of Peter I, and all of a sudden he dies in a drunken brawl. I would probably have a different theory. She got rid of him. As Tsarina, Catherine intended to continue the program of westernization begun by Peter III's grandfather, Peter the Great. Catherine founded Russia's first state-funded school for women in 1764 and began collecting the fine art that now comprises the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. When Catherine drafted a new law code for Russia, she made a public show of consulting her subjects. She summoned a legislative commission consisting of 142 delegates from the nobility, 209 delegates from the towns, and 200 delegates from the peasantry and ethnic minorities within her empire to contribute ideas to the legislative process. However, Catherine risked her reputation in the West as an enlightened ruler to expand her territory into Ukraine. While Catherine entertained European royalty and thinkers at her court, her armies fought in a war with the Ottoman Empire, modern-day Turkey, to control the Black Sea. Peter the Great had opened Russia up to the Baltic Sea, founding St. Petersburg on the Baltic coast, but it was Catherine who was determined to expand her southeastern frontier and develop a permanent Russian presence on the Black Sea. When the Russo-Turkish War began in 1768, the Tatars, who lived in the Crimea, remember descendants from Mongols, operated somewhat autonomously under a Khanate. The predominantly Muslim population descended from centuries of intermarriage between the native Turkish people and the Mongol armies who had occupied the region during Genghis Khan's time. They, though, had a fractious relationship with the surrounding Russian, Polish, Lithuanian empires because they raided their neighbors and engaged in human trafficking. As Russia expanded southward, these raids decreased in frequency but continued to occur until the annexation of Crimea. So, 250 years before Putin took the Crimea from Ukraine, Catherine took it from the Tatars. The Ukrainian peasantry could no more enjoy the freedom of mobility that they were once permitted as subjects of the Polish-Lithuanian Empire. Keep this in mind. The Ukraine suffered more under Russian ruler than they had under Polish-Lithuanian. Despite Catherine's attempts to forge an enlightened image, her espousal of serfdom led to brutal consequences and sustained criticism from her European neighbors. Moreover, Catherine owed her throne to the support of the nobility and therefore did little to improve the lives of the peasants who toiled on their estates. During Catherine's reign, something occurred that provided one of my most prized historical analogies. One of Catherine's ministers and her lover, Grigory Potemkin, had a hand in conquering part of the South for her. When she journeyed to look at the newly won regions, Potemkin was concerned that the desolation wrought in their conquest would be off-putting to the Tsarina. Therefore, he built a series of fake villages to mimic prosperity. The term became known for any deceptive or false construct as a Potemkin village. I did an entire podcast on Joe Biden's 2020 campaign, calling it rightly a Potemkin campaign. And today, it sometimes seems like Biden's is a Potemkin presidency. Yet rumors abound that Biden sometimes still makes the decisions as to, like, when he canceled a Polish sale of MiGs to Ukraine recently, you know, something that the Ukrainians really could have used to try to establish air supremacy. It was Biden who canceled it, and apparently it really was Biden. So maybe it's not so much a Potemkin presidency. So Biden still can be on hand to make all the wrong calls, something that he has a history of doing going back 30 years as far as foreign affairs. But nevertheless, Potemkin gave us the Potemkin village, an analogy I use again and again. So when we wonder, how did Russia get so big? We have seen their conquests all the way to the east, to the Pacific Ocean. We have seen their conquest to the north in beating Sweden. We have seen their conquest to the south in besting the Polish and Lithuanian states, and specifically the Ottoman Empire. And under Catherine's time, albeit with the alliance of Prussia and Austria, they actually took all of Poland. Poland was wiped off the map in three different partitions, gone. So therefore, Catherine now expanded to the west. And finally, we will look to the southeast. In Alexander Morrison's The Russian Conquest of Central Asia, A Study in Imperial Expansion, 1814 to 1914, the author writes, quote, "The Russian conquest of Central Asia was perhaps the 19th century's most dramatic and successful example of European imperial expansion, adding 1.5 million square miles and, unlike Siberia, at least 6 million people. But what's interesting is most of those 6 million, Central Asia, were Muslims. All of these were added to the Tsar's domains. From the earliest conflicts on the steppe frontier in the 1830s to the annexation of the Pamirs in the early 1900s, all of this expansion to the southeast took place. Now, I talked of logistics, something that Putin himself is struggling with, and something that the Russians have not been generally celebrated. But in fairness, the logistics and operations of those Russian wars in areas like Bukhara and Kiva, the capture of Tashkent and Samarkand, and the bloody subjugation of the Turkmen are, logistically at least, impressive feats, especially as dictated by far, far off St. Petersburg. Given a nation of this size, I have no doubt left out some aspects of the conquest. And as it is, I am making this walkthrough of Russian and Ukrainian history in not one but four podcasts, and I still feel as if I'm not doing it justice. We will not be spending time with Catherine's son, Paul. We will not, of his son, the enigmatic Alexander I, the Tsar who led Russia through the French invasion, we have to say this. Napoleon won the big battles and even occupied Moscow for a time. But what the Austrians, Italians, Prussians, or Russians could not do, the Russian winter and starvation did accomplish, the permanent crippling and ultimately the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte. After Alexander I, there was the first Nicholas, and it was his successor, Alexander II, who freed the Russian serfs some 400 years after it had happened in Western Europe. And Alexander II's reward for his liberal choice was to be assassinated, a lesson not lost on his son. Of the final seven czars, three were to die through violence. Alexander II's successor, Alexander III, tried to take Russia backward in his reversion to the authoritarianism so evident in Russian rulership history. His disposition bore little resemblance to his soft-hearted liberal father, Alexander II, and still less to his refined, philosophic, sentimental, chivalrous, French-speaking, yet cunning, great-uncle Tsar Alexander I. Nope, Alexander III was 6'3" and broad of back and shoulders, immensely strong and mentally sure of his aims. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, he died at age 49, leaving his son, Nicholas II, to reign at age 26. Now, It is easy for historians to become pop psychologists of historical figures, which can often warp the reading of history by injecting such conjecture. But it's difficult not to think that Nicholas II, the last of the czars, 8 inches shorter and about 100 pounds lighter than his father, always lived in his shadow, always questioning his decisions in a way his father never would. It could explain how Nicholas II would often give in to his willful wife Alexandra and his own family's later flirtations with Grigori Rasputin. But Alexander III would have certainly gone to war with Austria-Hungary and Germany to preserve Serbian autonomy and Russian honor in World War I, and it was in that conflict, that the seeds of Tsarist destruction were finally laid complete. We have covered off some of the czars, but critical ministers, such as Catherine Zorloff or Nicholas II's Sergei Vita, who tried to modernize Russia with his Trans-Siberian Railway, get short shrift. But one of the primary goals of this series of podcasts is to discern why Putin, and in that, it is best to focus on his Russian ruling predecessors. Of the pieces I have assembled, why this trip through the Tsardom conquests? Putin was a creature of the Soviet system coming out of the KGB, but he is more czar than commissar in many respects. His rejection of Lenin's arrangement and distinction of the Republic of Ukraine, one of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, is such a case. There is only the Russian Federation for Putin, not a series of republics as in the Soviet system. He would rather be Vladimir I than General Secretary Putin, and like monarchs throughout the ages, he put his personal needs, his desire for power and dominance, over the needs of his people. And it was the sheer size of the Russian Tsarist Empire that gave the pre-World War I triple entente of France, Great Britain, and Russia so much confidence. When arrayed against an upstart Germany, an ailing Austro-Hungary, and an untested Italy, the members of the Triple Alliance, on paper, the Entente felt they could not lose. When Peter I attempted to modernize his state, the effects of the time of troubles, still felt 100 years later, meant that Russia's population at 1700 was roughly equivalent to France at that time. But by 1900, Russia's population had increased all the way to 136 million people, more than Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy combined. Their combined numbers were 116 million. It was believed that the Russian steamroller would turn the tide, but the backwater economy, the lack of well-trained, well-equipped troops, and the rot at the heart of the Tsarist Empire would lead to ignominious defeat and the end of the Romanovs. The erosion could be seen before the war by anyone willing to look. First off, Japan severely defeated the Russians in a war in 1904, and this was by a nation that had only begun modernization just 50 years earlier. At one of the most surprising naval victories in history, Japanese Admiral Togo annihilated a Russian fleet at Tsushima. And the war itself led to an uprising in 1905 and Russia's first, though highly tentative, step towards representative government in the form of a body called the Duma, something that still exists today. But the Tsar, enforced by the brutal secret police he kept all of the real power. Now, much is made of the presence of Grigori Rasputin, a crazed monk who supposedly had mystical powers to heal Tsar Nicholas's only son, Alexei. And Alexei, of course, was the heir to the empire. But Rasputin only met the Romanovs in 1905 and only joined the family in 1908. He had nothing to do with the disaster of the Russo-Japanese War, nor the uprising in St. Petersburg in 1905. In December 1914, the Russian army had over 6.5 million men. However, they only had 4.6 million rifles. You can see the number problem there. As a result, untrained troops were ordered into battle without adequate resources, and some without even rifles. Quote, untrained troops were called into action without sufficient arms or ammunition, and because the Russian army had about one surgeon for every 10,000 men, many wounded of its soldiers died from wounds that would have been treated on the Western Front, that could have been saved by French or British doctors. With medical staff spread out across a 500-mile front, the likelihood of any Russian soldier receiving any medical treatment was close to zero, unquote. Despite some reforms in the preceding decade, the Russian army in 1914 was ill-equipped to fight a major war, and neither the political nor the military leadership was up to the standard required. Nevertheless, the army actually fought bravely, and both soldiers and junior officers showed remarkable qualities. The Russian invasion of East Prussia in August 1914 was defeated by Paul von Hindenburg and Erich Ludendorff at Tannenberg, which was a disaster for the Russians. But, and this is the important part, it required the Germans to send reinforcements from the Western Front and could have saved France from defeat and made possible the victory at the Marne. Interestingly, the Russians also did very well against the Austria-Hungarian army. Yet the cost of all of those Austrian achievements, and especially the cost of the war part against the Germans, was appalling. It was staggering. With the war going badly, in 1915, Tsar Nicholas II decided to replace the Grand Duke Nikolai as supreme commander of the Russian army fighting on the Eastern Front. The problem was, he was not a good general. He was disturbed when he received the following information from General Alexei Brusilov. Quote, "In recent battles, a third of the men had no rifles. These poor devils had to wait patiently until their comrades fell before their eyes and they could pick up weapons. The army is drowning in its own blood." Unquote. All told, and this does not include wounded or missing, but just simply killed, the Russian army lost 1.1 million men in the First World War before they exited in 1917. The collapse of the Tsarist regime came suddenly on March 8, 1917, planned by, well, no one, really. Several factories in Petrograd, St. Petersburg, new World War I name because the latter, St. Petersburg, sounded a little too Germanic, were on strike, and many of their workers were on the streets, as were the women in shopping queues and other women celebrating the Internationalist Socialist anniversary of Women's Day. These crowds turned into demonstrations, and the protests took over larger areas of the capital. The workers came out in the streets with political slogans, "Down with autocracy" and "Down with war." 2 days later, the emperor ordered the military governor to fire on the demonstrators, but the soldiers refused to use their rifles, and unit after unit went over to the workers. The police and gendarmes did shoot, and street fighting took place. And meanwhile, the Duma, which had been prorogued, refused to disperse. A Petrograd Soviet of workers' and soldiers' deputies were elected. On March 14th, the Duma, which had previously set up a standing committee, formed a provisional government, headed by Grigory Yevgenievich, and mainly composed of leaders of the Cadet and Oktoberist parties. The next day, a deputation visited the emperor at his headquarters and accepted his abdication on behalf of himself and his son. However, when his brother, Grand Duke Michael, refused the throne, the Romanov dynasty ended then and there. Nicholas was subsequently detained at his headquarters and was brought back to Petrograd. We will know that the Russian Revolution, there were actually two of them in 1917, in the following podcast. But we will end this one with the first brutality of what would be among the most brutal, Nazi Germany included, states in the history of humanity. And the brutality began with the death of Tsar Nicholas. The Russian Imperial Romanov family, Nicholas II of Russia, his wife Alexandra, and their five children, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, Anastasia, and Alexei, were shot and bayoneted to death by Bolshevik revolutionaries on the night of July 16, 1918. Also murdered that night were members of the imperial entourage who had accompanied them. The bodies were taken to a forest, stripped, buried, and mutilated with grenades to prevent identification. Now I want to make clear that despite some recent attempts, most notably the musical and movie Anastasia, and even his sainthood within the Russian Orthodox Church, all of these attempts to make Nicholas and his regime some royal paradise is a lie. Nicholas's secret police were brutal thugs and the treatment of the Russian people under the Romanovs was, at times, horrific. But whatever happened to Nicholas, Nicholas and Alexander's children were aged 22 to 13. Little doubt, evil men such as Vladimir Lenin, Joseph Stalin could justify this by suggesting that they were stamping out future centers of counter-revolution by brutally murdering children. But their savagery is without justification, just as Russian troops bombing hospitals and maternity wards are doing today. Now, for our next podcast, we'll look at the Soviet Union, and in addition to a trip through a new time of troubles, we will also take a look at the Americans, useful idiots in Lenin parlance, such as John Reed, Rex Tugwell, and even our own Bernie Sanders, who helped put a gloss on what is arguably the worst regime in human history. Thank you for listening to this latest podcast from The Conservative Historian, and I hope that you check out all of our podcasts, including the previous two podcasts on Russian and Ukrainian history in this series. This is Bell Office. Thanks for listening.